Elder Hostel and other tour groups for the active aged, and she was into her body. In Las Vegas, Phoebe jogged along the strip each morning, all the way down to the Stratosphere and back. She worked out in the gym, she tanned by the pool, she had a bikini wax and a facial and a hot stone massage. She dragged the rest of the girls to Ferragamo and Illy Tahari and Prada and Armani and Gucci and Ralph Lauren. Phoebe was a size 2, and Addison made millions of dollars. Why wouldn't she go shopping? Andrea tired of it first. She would stand in the concourse and call Mrs. Parks from her cell phone to check on the kids. Delilah and Tess hung in there a little longer. Tess could fit in things, but she had no money. Teacher's salary, she moaned. Phoebe offered to buy her whatever she wanted, but they had a rule among the group about no gifts. It was a good rule, Delilah decided, especially since she sensed Phoebe trying to buy Tess's love. That wasn't exactly a fair assessment, because Phoebe offered to buy things for Delilah, too. But Delilah had full breasts and a curvy ass that Versace didn't design for. Eventually, Delilah and Tess started going for gelato while Phoebe shopped and Andrea phoned, and when they reunited, they were happy. Tess and Delilah shared their gelato, Phoebe showed off what she had bought, Andrea gave them the lowdown on the kids. They were happy in different configurations. Jeffrey wanted to see the Hoover Dam. So he and Delilah rented a burgundy Ford Mustang convertible and asked who else wanted to go. Phoebe was a no, and Addison decided to stay with Phoebe. Tess was a no, and Andrea decided to stay with Tess. Greg wanted to go, and so did the chief. The chief drove because he was the chief, and Jeffrey sat up front because he had rented the car. Delilah and Greg sat in the back, taking in the sun and the wind and the desert. The dam was astounding, mind-blowing, 726 feet of concrete holding back a biblical amount of water. Delilah stood in genuine awe. She had gone along because her husband was keen on it and because she couldn't take any more shopping or smoke or signage, and as they descended down the middle of the dam with a tour guide, she congratulated herself on her fine decision. What if she had missed this? As they waited for the elevator that would take them back up to the top of the dam, Greg whispered in Delilah's ear, "I should have brought a joint." Delilah giggled, less out of amusement than out of a sense of conspiracy, because she and Greg were the only two of the group who smoked dope, much to the dismay of their respective spouses. Jeffrey looked at Delilah sharply. The tour guide was in the middle of a discourse on the WPA, and Delilah felt bonded to Greg even more. They were the bad teenagers disrupting class. Hadn't it always been that way when Delilah was growing up? She had led boys astray, or she had let them lead her astray. She was always pushing the envelope, forever getting into trouble. They stopped for a late lunch at a roadhouse on the way back to Vegas, and Delilah and Greg polished off 3 Coronas apiece and started telling stories about the sexual mishaps of their younger years. They laughed like fools, spurting beer all over the table, while the chief looked on with mild indulgence. Sex wasn't against the law, after all, and Jeffrey glowered. "Why don't you guys tell stories?" Delilah asked. They were embarrassed by the question, and Delilah knew why. It was Andrea, the woman they'd shared. The chief would not tell any stories about other women for fear of disrespecting Andrea in front of Jeffrey. Jeffrey, Delilah knew, had only slept with 2 women, herself and Andrea, and that sewed that up pretty tight. It was not funny to tell stories about his own wife, nor about the wife of someone else at the table. Jeffrey motioned for the check. Delilah excused herself for the bathroom. 20 minutes beyond the roadhouse, Delilah had to pee again. "You just went," Jeffrey snapped. Delilah had read somewhere that the human bladder could expand to the size of a grapefruit. Hers was a basketball, a wobbly and distended water balloon. She had to go now. She was seconds away from letting the stream go, hot and grateful all over the backseat of the rental car. She intoned as much. The chief pulled over, and Delilah climbed out of the Mustang without using the door. She crouched behind the exhaust pipe and lifted her prairie skirt. Her flow ran in rivulets over the hard, red dirt. Jeffrey held his forehead in his hand. He couldn't believe she was doing this, even though it was the kind of thing she was always doing. She climbed back into the car, grinning. "Okay," she said, "ready to go." Delilah leaned her head back against the seat, catching the last angled rays of sun on her face. She was happy. The afternoon she went to see the Hoover Dam remained one of the singular afternoons of her life. Greg and the chief and Andrea got up early and walked to New York, New York for Krispy Kreme donuts. Addison and Tess and Delilah went to the Bellagio to see the Impressionist collection. Andrea and Addison and Delilah and Greg were addicted to the slot machines. They each walked around carrying a plastic cup of quarters and would stop to play when someone else in the group went to the bathroom. In the MGM Grand, Addison hit it big. The coins splashed down. He won $1,700. Everyone else groaned. Of all of them, Addison needed the money the least. He seemed abashed by the win. He pinkened all the way over his bald pate, or maybe he'd gotten too much sun by the pool with Phoebe. "I'll buy dinner," he said, "wherever you want to go." They all agreed this was a wonderful idea, despite the rule of no gifts. They went to Le Cirque because they had all heard of it, even the chief, who claimed to know nothing about the finer things in life. Addison had actually been to the original Le Cirque in New York with his first wife. She had gone to boarding school with one of Sirio Macchione's sons. Phoebe complained that it was no fun to be the second wife and lead the second life with a person who had done it all, and done it well, the first time around. She complained privately to Delilah as they moved en masse down the strip through the throngs of people, sidestepping the short immigrant men who handed out cheap business cards about massage and dancing girls. Delilah was only half listening. She had had a fight with Jeffrey and could not stop fretting about it. The fight had taken place as they were getting ready for dinner. Delilah ordered a bottle of Sancerre from room service. It arrived, elegant and cold, and Delilah, wrapped in her white, waffled robe, waited as the bellman poured two glasses. She tipped him $10. Jeffrey was soaking, dutifully, in the two-person tub. The tub was merely atmosphere. It was foreplay. Delilah had it all planned out. Wine together in the tub, wild sex either on the impressive acreage of their California king bed or on the plush bathroom rug, followed by a long shower for Delilah. She wanted to get the cigarette smoke and the 24-hour miasma of the casino out of her hair and off her skin. But when she submerged in the tub and handed Jeffrey his wine, he said, "You really disappoint me. You know that?" It was his choice of the word disappoint that struck Delilah first. It was such a parental word. "Why?" Delilah said. "Carrying on like you did with Greg at the Hoover Dam." "Carrying on? You were like a couple of kids. The pot joke, the sex stories, and then you lifted your skirt in front of everyone. You pissed in front of everyone. I was embarrassed." "Embarrassed? Mortified. You're a grown woman. You're my wife." "So? You have no idea how to behave, no sense of decorum." "Decorum? It was disgusting. Three beers at lunch and a shot of tequila?" She didn't realize he'd seen the shot of tequila. But yes, Greg had shanghaied her on the way back from the ladies' room, and they'd each thrown back a shot of Patron Silver, quick and neat. "I can't stand this," she said. "What?" "Being monitored like this. Being lectured on decorum. We're on vacation, Jeffrey. We're in Las Vegas." "That's no excuse." She stood up, unsteadily, and climbed out of the tub. "Fuck you," she said, though she meant the opposite. There would be no wild sex. She stepped into the shower. When she emerged, Jeffrey was sitting on the edge of the bed, dressed in his navy suit, looking somber and morose, like a funeral director. "I want an apology," he said. "Apology?" Delilah said. "Ha! I'm the one who deserves an apology." "And why is that?" He turned his head stiffly, like a ventriloquist's dummy. "Because you're acting like my father," she said. She pulled a dress on over her head. Phoebe would have something new for tonight, a thought that was both demoralizing and infuriating. Phoebe had worn a new dress every night of the trip so far. And don't forget, I ran away from my father.
Meaning what? Jeffrey said.
Meaning, what do you think? Delilah said. She foraged through her suitcase for her other black slingback. There was a knock at the door. It was Tess, fresh-faced and grinning like a Girl Scout. Ready? She said. Still, they were happy at dinner. Le Cirque was as glamorous a place as Delilah had ever eaten in, and she was relaxed knowing that Addison would take the bill. He ordered 2 bottles of Cristal. Delilah's spirits rose. Greg was to her left, Jeffrey to her right, and Andrea on Jeffrey's other side. Tess was next to Greg, Addison between Tess and Phoebe, the chief between Phoebe and Andrea. The vacation had them breaking up into small groups. It had them rearranging and forging unusual allies, but when they sat down for a meal together, they always sat like this. It was curious. The champagne came, and Phoebe, assuming the role of first lady, because Addison was paying for dinner or because she had organized the trip, Delilah wasn't sure, wanted to make a toast. "To us," she said, "the castaways." "The castaways," everyone said. Glasses clinked, none crossing. Phoebe swore it was bad luck. Delilah sipped her Cristal. She was normally counted on to get the conversation rolling, but tonight she wouldn't do it. She wasn't in the mood. No one understood how difficult it was to come up with new, interesting things to talk about with people who had exhausted every topic under the sun. No one gave her any credit for her conversational gymnastics, and she was pretty sure Jeffrey resented it. How many times had she heard it? "You talked a lot at dinner." Tonight she would observe all the rules of proper decorum. She would not get bawdy. She would not be the first one to bring up sex or drinking or other lewd topics. She pressed her lips shut. There was a lull at the table. They were waiting for her. "What is the greatest song the Rolling Stones ever recorded? I say Loving Cup. Andrea, how about you?" No, she wouldn't. Was anyone looking at her? She didn't care. She didn't care if they ate their whole meal in awkward silence. She studied her menu. Out of the blue, the chief started talking. This was truly amazing, as the chief normally said very little, in the way that serious men who had important, quasi-confidential jobs said very little. The chief had apparently bumped into an officer with the LVPD at the roulette wheel. The chief showed his badge. The other officer was on the vice squad, he said. The chief and this officer chatted it up for quite a while. "You would not believe the things he told me," the chief said.
"Like what?" Delilah said, forgetting to keep her mouth shut.
The chief drank from his beer bottle. The waiter had wanted to pour the beer in a glass, but the chief held his palm up and said, "It comes in a bottle," in a way that was very chief-like. He shook his head at Delilah. He wasn't going to tell them anything else. He was famous for bringing up teasers like that and letting them drop. "Okay, fine, forget it. Delilah wouldn't push it, though the life of a Las Vegas vice squad officer sounded fascinating if you loved the raw and the raunchy, which Delilah did. And it would be relevant besides. But she'd taken a vow of silence, and she meant to stick to it." Phoebe regaled the table with details of her hours by the pool. "Okay, does everyone in this town have fake boobs or what?" And Delilah's mind wandered. It became clear, now that she had stepped out of her role as the conversational master of ceremonies, how firmly established that role was. They all had their roles, each one of them. They had their personalities, proclivities, interests, likes, and dislikes. They were adults, they were known quantities. Was this good or bad? They could not surprise each other. They were not likely to change or act out of character. Like the chief insisting on drinking his beer from a bottle, even here at Le Cirque, because that was how he drank his beer. Utterly predictable. But the roles gave them comfort. The lack of surprise lent security, a sense of understanding, friendship, family, acceptance.
right?
The chief was their spiritual leader. He was their man in case of emergency. He was the best problem solver, though Jeffrey was a damn close second. He was the police chief. He knew everything and he knew it first, but he gave nothing away. The man was a vault. If they ever broke him open, what would they find? A treasure trove of secrets and confidences bound up by his honor. The chief was principled and discreet. He was part of a fraternity across the country, across the world. Law enforcement, the earth's finest. Andrea was the den mother, Mother Earth, Mother Nature. Delilah had always thought it would be boring to be Andrea. She was matronly, sexless. She wore skirts to the knee and one-piece bathing suits. She wore comfortable shoes. But Andrea seemed content. She wasn't looking for anything. She wasn't searching for herself, trying on identities or attitudes the way Delilah sometimes did, the way Tess and Phoebe did too. Andrea had a firm grip on who she was, and this left her plenty of time and energy to focus on others, the chief, her kids, Tess. When Delilah was 60 or 70, she wanted to be just like Andrea. She said this once to Jeffrey, and Jeffrey made a face indicating that he found the statement ridiculous or inappropriate. Jeffrey had been in love with Andrea years and years ago. They had dated, kissed, groped, copulated, fallen in love, moved in together. They had talked about marriage and kids. But back then, Jeffrey wasn't ready. Andrea was the first woman he'd made love to. Jeffrey's longtime girlfriend in high school and college, Felicity Hammer, was a devout Baptist, determined to remain chaste until her wedding day. And so for 6 years, Jeffrey was dragged along on that virginal ride. But Jeffrey didn't leave Andrea because he had wild oats to sow. He left her because he had real oats to sow, real corn, real vegetables. He'd inherited 162 acres of fertile farmland, a legitimate business opportunity, and he wanted to succeed. He could not put the farm first and put Andrea first. They broke up. It was, in his words, very sad. This could have moved Delilah right along to thinking about Jeffrey, but she couldn't allow herself to deconstruct him. He was her husband, she knew him too well, and she was angry. She would skip him. "You really disappoint me." God, it infuriated her, but it did not surprise her. Addison was talking now, rescuing them from Phoebe's discourse on life as seen from the Chase Lounge. He was describing Las Vegas real estate trends. Addison loved trends, and how the old casinos, the Sands, the Golden Nugget, the Desert Inn, were being medicine-balled and replaced by theme park giants, the Luxor, the Venetian, Treasure Island. The waiter reappeared, and they ordered. Delilah ordered the salad frisée avec lardon and the steak. Jeffrey wanted the beets, but would not order them because they were out of season, and so he went with the grapefruit and avocado salad and the pasta with lump crab meat. Even their ordering could not surprise her. Phoebe ordered a salad with roasted vegetables. Addison and the chief got the steak, like Delilah. Addison was the businessman, the money man. His last name was Wheeler, and every single person on Nantucket called him Wheeler Dealer. Addison was tall and thin and bald. He wore horn-rimmed glasses. He was part nerd, part aristocrat. His father had owned a carpet and flooring business in New Brunswick. His mother had been a nurse in the infirmary at Rutgers. Until high school, Addison's life had been very Exit 8. It had been McDonald's after football games. It had been Bruce Springsteen and summers spent down the shore. But like cream, Addison rose to the top. If you believed him, he did so without trying. He was bright, polite, and charming. He had a silver tongue. He was a social genius, and because of this, he stood out. The junior high school principal suggested that Addison make a run at boarding school, where he could take advantage of some real opportunities. He got into Lawrenceville based on his interview alone. From Lawrenceville, he went to Princeton, where he was president of his eating club, Cottage. There was something funny about his graduation, and by funny, Delilah meant peculiar. He hadn't had the correct credits at the end of his senior year to get his diploma.
He had finished up the following summer at Rutgers. Had he graduated from Rutgers then, technically? Or was it a Princeton diploma with a Rutgers asterisk? Delilah had also heard that Addison had been thrown out of Princeton for conducting an affair with the wife of the Dean of Arts and Sciences, whom Addison had met at a faculty cocktail party he'd crashed. Now that sounded like Addison, but Delilah did not have confirmation of that story, and the one time she had been brave enough to ask Phoebe, Phoebe had said dismissively, "I can't keep track of all the stories. The man has had 9 lives." That was the truth about Addison. He had had 9 lives. The stories were too numerous and Byzantine to keep track of. Which were real and which were lore? He claimed to have lived in Belfast, Naples, and Paris while working as a broker for Coldwell Banker. But he had only just turned 40. How had he possibly fit it all in? He spoke fluent French and Italian. He spoke Gaelic. He knew everything there was to know about food and wine, painting, sculpture, architecture, classical music, literature. His first wife was an anorexically thin rubber heiress named Mary Rose Garth, who had a brownstone in Gramercy Park and a penchant for younger men. Her personal trainer, the handsome Puerto Rican doorman. Mary Rose had taken Addison for the ride of his life. She had shown him all of the best ways in the world to spend money. But she had been too much even for Addison. They divorced amicably, and Mary Rose now lived in Malibu with their daughter, Vanessa. If you were to believe Addison, Mary Rose and Vanessa shared boyfriends. Delilah ate her steak. She had asked for it rare, and it had come perfectly cooked, seared on the outside, dark pink on the inside. Addison had also ordered his steak rare, but the chief had ordered his well done. Predictable. They had moved on to drinking a red wine from Argentina. Shocking, since Addison was a Francophile. But it was the most incredible wine Delilah had ever tasted. It was like drinking velvet. It was like drinking the blood of your one true love. If she said this, everyone would laugh. Phoebe would say, "God, Delilah, you are so clever," and mean it. And Jeffrey would shake his head, embarrassed. Andrea was talking about her kids, Dullsville, but Delilah would not save her. In her mind, she moved on to Phoebe. Phoebe was Delilah's best friend, though they were an odd match. Phoebe was blonde, stick-thin, never caught in public without perfectly applied Chanel lipstick. She was a cruise director, a cheerleader. She was the pep squad. She was a trophy wife. She liked being all these things. The stereotype was her identity, and she relished it. The shopping, the waxing, the Valentino heels, the Dior perfume. Her slavish devotion to Sex and the City. She did not cook, she did not clean or do laundry, but she did take spinning and yoga classes. She did avoid red meat, as well as chicken and fish and all starches. It seemed like she ate the same way that she drank champagne, sparingly on special occasions. Tonight she had ordered a beautiful leafy salad with a timbale of roasted vegetables, but at home it was all rice cakes, navel oranges, and mineral water. What Delilah had learned, however, was that there was depth to Phoebe. The woman was a fantastic administrator. She sat on the boards of directors of 2 charities. She co-chaired events that raised ludicrous amounts of money. She ran her consulting business with acuity. She was as shrewd as Addison. Shrewder, perhaps, because whereas Addison was acknowledged as being shrewd, Phoebe was considered ditzy and vacuous. Phoebe came from a close-knit family from Milwaukee. She had grown up with loving parents and a twin brother, Reed, whom she adored. They were the kinds of twins who created their own language. They were, in Phoebe's words, just like the twins in Flowers in the Attic, minus all the nasty stuff. Her parents, Joan and Phil, were still married, still living in a Center Hall colonial in Whitefish Bay, still sustaining themselves on the milk and cheese of Phoebe and Reed's youth. Reed was a fantastically successful bond trader in New York. Phoebe talked to him at least twice a day. He invested her money. He had made her millions. Something fell and hit Delilah's foot. It was Greg's spoon, one of Greg's many spoons. This dinner required the full Emily Post lineup of utensils. He bent down to retrieve it, A very un-Emily Post-like move. How many times had Delilah's mother told her that when you dropped a utensil, you were to leave it be and ask the server to bring you another one? Delilah felt Greg's fingers fondling her left heel. She was shocked, but she kept her expression steady. His fingers kept going. He dragged them up the back of Delilah's calf to the crease in her knee. This was outrageous. It was unprecedented. There had been new allies forged on this trip, yes, and maybe Greg, like Jeffrey, was recalling their flirtatious afternoon at the Hoover Dam. But to fondle her foot under the table during dinner? Greg surfaced like a kid trolling the bottom of a swimming pool for coins, holding his spoon aloft. Got it! It might seem like Addison and Phoebe were the couple who were the most mysterious, respectively unknowable and misunderstood. But Delilah was baffled by Greg and Tess, because they somehow had won. They were everybody's favorites. They were Boy Bright and Susie Sunshine. They had what everybody wanted. With Greg, it was easy to understand. Greg was, after all, their rock star. He played guitar and piano. He sang. He had shaggy brown hair and intense green eyes and a day of growth on his face. He was 6 feet tall, shorter than Jeffrey by 5 inches and Addison by 3, but his body was that of a professional surfer. He had six-pack abs and the shoulders of Adonis. He had a vine tattoo encircling his left bicep. He wore 2 silver hoops in his left ear and a silver ring on the second toe of his left foot, which only someone like Greg could pull off. If there was a woman in the world who was resistant to the charms of Greg McAvoy, Delilah had yet to meet her. In a way, Delilah was immune. His looks and charm were a virus she had encountered many times before. She prided herself on being Greg's buddy, his partner in crime. She did not fantasize about Greg. She did not desire him. But this thing that had just transpired under the table, what was this? A joke, she decided. A harmless funny. She looked at Tess. Had Tess noticed anything strange? She had not. She was listening with ridiculous, eager attention to Andrea talk about Eric's crush on the elementary school art teacher. Tess was the ingenue, the baby sister. She was Amy in Little Women. She was Franny Glass. Adored, coddled, spoiled, adored some more. It helped that she was small, 5 feet tall, 97 pounds, and it helped that she had thick, dark hair cut into a bob and tucked behind her ears, showing off her pearl earrings or her microscopic diamond studs. It helped that she had freckles and a Minnie Mouse voice. It helped that she was the nicest, kindest, most generous person on the face of the earth. She loved babies and animals. She cried at movies and AT&T long-distance commercials. She sponsored an orphan in Brazil, an 8-year-old girl named Esmeralda, and in addition to sending regular checks, Tess sent boxes packed with brown rice, muesli, coloring books, Crayola markers and colored pencils, jigsaw puzzles, modeling clay, a hairbrush, barrettes, packages of new underwear, a toothbrush, floss, toothpaste, stickers, a flashlight, and a special-ordered copy of A Little Princess in Portuguese. Only Tess. She was a good egg, for real. She never had a mean word for anyone. She loved Greg and Andrea and the chief and the rest of them with unbridled intensity. It felt good to have Tess like you, to have Tess love you. It felt like sunshine. It felt like warm chocolate sauce over your ice cream. Greg was no dummy. He could have had any woman he wanted, and so he snapped up the prize, Tess DeRosa. He had been playing with his band at the Muse, and Tess had been in the front row wearing, how many times had Delilah heard the story, jeans and a green bandana on her hair. And Greg said to his bass player, "Hey, that little Gidget girl is hot." They were, now, the perfect couple. Or were they? Delilah was suspicious. She didn't believe in perfect couples. She didn't believe in perfect families. Delilah told off-color jokes and stories. She threw decorum to the wind. And people liked this about her because on some level everyone related. Life was messy. It did fart and burp. It left a stink in the bathroom and bloodstains on the sheets. Polite society had an underbelly. People led complicated secret lives. And this fascinated Delilah. But what did she know? Greg's hand on her foot.
Her leg.
Dessert was served, and Delilah was tired of thinking. She wanted to talk. She cleared her throat, and everyone at the table looked at her. They were hungry for her.
"Greatest band of all time," Delilah said. "Who is it?"
She pointed at Greg. "You're not allowed to say the porn stars."
"Or the European bikinis," Addison said.
They were off and running.
By the time they left Le Cirque, they were all drunk. Happy drunk. Too drunk for Wayne Newton, too drunk for Barry Manilow, too drunk for O. Too drunk for the crooner in the cheesy lounge at Caesar's, who liked to end his cabaret show with "someone left the cake out in the rain." But not ready for bed.
Not yet. It wasn't even midnight.
What to do? The Bellagio fountains? Again? No. The White Tigers at the Mirage? No. A drink at the Venetian? No. Slots? Maybe, just for a minute. Howie Mandel? No.
They decided to go to Circus Circus to ride the roller coaster. This was Tess's idea, and since she was Cindy Brady and since she never got to decide anything, that was what they did. They were all dressed up, but no matter. They filed two by two, couples only this time, into the roller coaster cars, with Delilah and Jeffrey up front. Delilah leaned her head against Jeffrey's shoulder. She squeezed the hell out of Jeffrey's farmer hand, which was as wide and sturdy as a spade. No one would believe this. It would in fact surprise them. But Delilah was afraid of roller coasters. Terrified. And not just in the way that normal people were afraid of roller coasters. She was in full freak-out mode. Her heart was a crazed animal that had been zapped with high-voltage electricity. She thought she might cry, or insist on staying on the ground where it was safe. But this was a group thing, Tess had picked it, and Delilah would not be the spoiler. She clung to Jeffrey. The man was a walking, talking security blanket. He was not going to let anything happen to Delilah. That, in the end, was why she had married him. She didn't need excitement or trouble from a man. She created enough of that on her own.
"You're the best person in the world to ride a roller coaster with," she said to her husband.
It seemed he did not need this explained to him. He took it the way it was meant, as an apology.
"Thank you," he said.
The roller coaster lurched forward. Delilah shrieked. They hadn't even gone anywhere.
"Here we go! Eee!"
The roller coaster jerked upward. It ticked ominously up the incline. Delilah had her back braced against the seat. Her heart wanted out. Oh my God. It would be thrilling, she thought. A thrill all the better because it was so damn scary. They crested, the car hesitating at the top. Delilah could not see the bottom of the chute, but she could sense it. The air beneath her, the breath-stealing trajectory. They plunged. Delilah's stomach fell away. It was somewhere over her head. She screamed. They all screamed. They hadn't known then what was coming. They didn't know about September 11th, Phoebe's twin brother jumping from the 101st floor. They didn't know about lost pregnancies. They didn't know about the pharmaceutical cornucopia targeted at post-traumatic stress disorder. They didn't know about the ways their marriages would fall apart and then be saved. They didn't know about affairs or love realigning. They didn't know about a girl named April Peck or the shitstorm she would create. They didn't know they were going to leave and be left. They didn't know they were going to die. They screamed. Back then, they had all been happy.
Addison. For maybe 10 years now, Addison Wheeler had considered himself a rich man. He had a beautiful home, 4 cars, membership in 2 private clubs, a case of 1967 port in his wine cellar, and 8 figures invested with his broker in New York. He had a 16-year-old daughter in the best private school in Southern California, and an ex-wife who was so wealthy on her own that all she asked Addison for were special favors. He had a client who could get him tickets to anything, anywhere, the Super Bowl, the Academy Awards. But from now on, money would mean nothing. Money couldn't help him. Money didn't matter. Tess was dead. They gathered at the Drake House, because they always gathered at the Drake House.
Greg and Tess's house was too small. Andrea and the chief's house was too police chiefy. There was a scanner in their house that squawked all the livelong day, and somewhere in the house, everyone knew, the chief kept guns. Addison and Phoebe had the biggest house, with views over Sessacatcha Pond. From their widow's walk, you could see all three of Nantucket's lighthouses. Addison and Phoebe had tried to host gatherings in the past, but these gatherings were never quite right. Phoebe raided the fancy Italian cheese store for hundreds of dollars worth of Asiago and salumi, and Addison, hands down, had the best wine, not to mention the most sophisticated stereo and TV, but something was missing. Their house was too cold, too formal. They had no kids. That might have been the problem. And yet in their basement was a home theater with every DVD from The Breakfast Club to B-movie, as well as a pool table. They had beanbag chairs, a basketball hoop, and a swimming pool, half of which was only 3 feet deep. It was heaven for kids, so that wasn't the problem. The problem was something else. Or maybe this was just Addison's insecurity talking. He was rich, yes, but not rich enough to quiet the voice in his head that constantly reminded him of his shortcomings. Maybe it wasn't that there was anything wrong with Addison and Phoebe's house. The Drake house was simply better. It was warmer. It was, in essence, a farmhouse, with a captivating mix of woods and woven rugs, bright fabrics, copper pots, a fire in the fireplace, or the grill smoking on the deck. Delilah made everything from scratch, rather than buying it prepared. She was an easy, natural hostess, pouring your drink before your coat was off. She made the most delicious cocktails, she had the funniest cocktail napkins, she cooked with cream and butter, herbs, and just-picked produce. She had the best mixes on her iPod, and she was always, always ready to turn it up a notch. Addison loved it at the Drake house, and Phoebe would have put their own house on the market and moved in with the Drakes at the drop of a hat. There was just something about it. It was happy, balanced. But not, of course, today. Addison and Phoebe arrived at 7:10, though it felt much earlier. It was the longest day of the year. The chief and Andrea had arrived, and instinctively Addison looked for Tess's Kia. For the past 6 months, when he had pulled into this driveway, he had looked for Tess's car. He had her license plate memorized, K22M3E. He had waited dozens of times over the past winter for that car to pull into the driveway of the cottage in Quays, an exclusive listing of his, where they used to meet. Tess's car wasn't there. It was in the lot across from the town pier. Next to him, Phoebe was as still and quiet as a statue in a garden. She had self-medicated, which was dangerous after an event like this, but Addison hadn't the wherewithal to check what she had put in her mouth. He tried to monitor what Dr. Field prescribed her, what she took, what she stashed away, what she gave to Delilah. Phoebe was a very generous woman, even with her pharmaceuticals. But this had dropped off in recent months, partly because of Tess, and partly because the responsibility of being on constant watch with his wife was wearying. He had tried lecturing. He had tried an intervention, a mini-intervention, him and Dr. Field, explaining to Phoebe that she was becoming dependent on these drugs and she had to wean herself off them, the antidepressants, the pain meds, the sleep aids. Nothing worked. Phoebe popped pills, and rather than killing her, they seemed to be keeping her alive. So whereas Addison felt like he wanted to take a steak knife and eviscerate his insides, cut his heart out so it would stop hurting, Tess was dead. Phoebe was as calm as a houseplant. She wasn't a person so much as a topiary. Addison turned off the car. He wasn't sure that he could go into that house and pull off the acting job that was required. "He killed her," Addison said. Phoebe turned to him. "What?" she said. There had been a text message sent to his phone at 9:45 that morning. Addison had been in his office reviewing the purchase and sale agreement for the big deal. He saw that the text was from Tess, and he willed it to say, "I love you." He found he needed constant reassurance of this from her. But when he opened it, it said, "I'm afraid." He had stared at the message, wondering how to respond. Tess was right to be afraid. Addison himself was terrified. Greg was pulling out all the stops to win her back. She had to be careful. She had to resist him. The text came just as they would have been sailing out of the harbor, so Addison thought that Tess meant she was afraid of the water. She had nearly drowned in Dorchester Bay as a child. She swam with her kids at the beach, but only on the north shore where the water was placid, and even then she went right in and came right out. When her kids were swimming in Addison's pool, she stood at the side, vigilant, even though Chloe and Finn had suffered through years of swimming lessons, born from this very same fear. Sailing, fishing, boating, snorkeling, scuba diving, even the ferry back and forth to the mainland made Tess uncomfortable. She remembered what it had been like, at age 9, to slip under the water's surface and not be able to fight her way back up. Addison shuddered. Phoebe said, "I think we should offer to take the kids." "Let's go in," Addison said. The Drake House was not the Drake House. There was no food or drink, no music, no Delilah. In the living room, Jeffrey sat with the chief, face to face, saying nothing. Addison said, "We're here." The two men nodded. Phoebe said, "Where's Delilah?" "In our bedroom," Jeffrey said. "Waiting for you." Phoebe said, "Where are the kids?" "Downstairs." "Do they know?" Addison asked. "Not yet," the chief said.
"We'll take them," Phoebe said. "We have lots of room."
"Phoebe," Addison said. He should have headed off this notion while they were still outside. No one was going to be comfortable with Addison and Phoebe taking even temporary custody of the kids. "One step at a time," the chief said. "Where's Andrea?" Addison said. "Asleep upstairs," the chief said. "Asleep?" "The doctor gave her something. She can't handle it. Tess was everything to her." "She was everything to me," Addison thought, "and no one will ever know it." "I'm afraid," the text had said. Phoebe tiptoed down the hall to Delilah. Downstairs, Addison could hear the kids. "What happened, exactly?" Addison said. "It's not clear," the chief said. "The boat capsized. They drowned. They got caught underneath the boat. Greg's foot was tangled in the ropes. They had been drinking." Addison pictured Tess and Greg on the deck of the boat, drinking champagne, eating strawberries, kissing, talking. About what? There was so much anger between the two of them, so much suspicion and confusion about what had happened the previous fall with April Peck. Greg had never come clean. He stuck to his preposterous story. Addison had asked him once when they were both very drunk, "Tell me what happened, man, the truth." And Greg had hesitated, as if thinking about it. Could he trust Addison? He and Addison were very close friends. But in the end, the answer must have been no. He said, "Man, I already told everybody the truth." It ate away at Tess. Her trust in Greg had been destroyed. She didn't believe in anything anymore, not marriage, not friendship. She had fallen in love with Addison, or she claimed to have fallen in love. Addison worried that Tess was using him unconsciously. God, of course unconsciously, the woman didn't have a mean bone in her body to get back at Greg. She still cared what Greg thought. She worried what Greg did, where he went, whom he saw. The Coast Guard retrieved their things, Greg's guitar, the picnic basket, their shoes. "He killed her," Addison whispered. He said this to himself. He was in such agony he couldn't help it, and he didn't care if they knew what he thought. They did not hear him. The chief said, "Greg thought he was a better sailor than he was. He had no business trying to get them to the vineyard. I should have stopped them." "I should have stopped them," Addison said. He had been dying to tell her not to go. He had wanted to give her an ultimatum. "If you love me, you won't go." But at the time, he hadn't seen that this would accomplish anything besides upsetting Tess, and possibly learning some things he didn't want to know. such as that she still loved Greg, despite her anger and distrust, such as that if Addison forced her to choose, him or me, she would choose him. But if he'd insisted, she might still be alive. "I'm going downstairs now to tell the kids," the chief said. "Or I could do it," Jeffrey offered. "I had pictured this as Andrea's territory," the chief said. "But she isn't capable." "And neither is Delilah," Jeffrey said. "I'm their uncle," the chief said. He took an audible breath, and Addison noticed how old he looked. A bad sign, since he and Addison were the same age, 49. "I've done a lot of crappy duties with this job, but this is the worst," Jeffrey said. "The worst," Addison echoed. He was so upset, but there was no way for him to express it. Should he be the one going down to tell Chloe and Finn their parents were dead? Absolutely not. And yet he and Tess had been so intimate. For the past 6 months, it had been just the two of them in a make-believe world, a carefully preserved fantasy, touching, kissing, experiencing unprecedented tenderness. They were simpatico. He held her while she slept. He listened to her. He bought her cookies and marzipan and truffles for her sweet tooth. He tickled her. They laughed. He combed her hair. She rubbed his back. And when they parted, she cried, "I don't want to go back to him." After Easter, they had begun to talk about running away, living together. Addison was the one who broached the subject first. He had loads of money. He could make anything happen. He could pay lawyers. He could leave Phoebe the house, and they could buy a new house together. They could buy the cottage. Then they would never have to leave, never have to say goodbye. Tess played along, but not wholeheartedly. Addison sensed she was repeating his words back to him because she knew it made him happy. Never have to leave, never have to say goodbye. He loved her more than he had ever loved anyone else, including fiery Mary Rose Garth, including Phoebe, including his own daughter. Tess unlocked something in him. Everything he'd done, everything he'd seen, everything he owned had meant nothing until she became his. She gave him a reason. But would Tess want him to be the one to tell her kids that she was dead? He was sure the answer was no. The chief went downstairs. Addison and Jeffrey sat together in awkward silence. They were waiting, listening for what? Addison's own daughter, Vanessa, was high-strung and prone to melodrama. If informed that he or Mary Rose was dead, Vanessa would shriek to break glass. She would climb into her Miata and drive like Richard Petty through Beverly Hills, wailing to her friends on her cell phone. But how would two sweet, level-headed 7-year-olds react? Addison and Jeffrey waited. The happy noise downstairs quieted. Then Addison heard footsteps on the stairs. He turned. It was Jeffrey's boys, Drew and Barney. They were crying the way boys cried once they'd outgrown the baby stuff. Red eyes, tears, but no noise. Jeffrey said, "Come here," and opened his arms.
"The chief told us," Drew said. "Then he asked us to come upstairs."
"He needs time with Chloe and Finn," Jeffrey said. He hugged his boys fiercely and made a grunting noise. Addison both recognized it. "I love you guys. I will always love you. We are so lucky this isn't us," and was made uncomfortable by it. The emotion was so raw he felt voyeuristic. Addison stood up. In the mud room, he found the bag the chief had collected from the Coast Guard, the personal effects. Addison lifted Greg's guitar out of the bag. "I'm afraid." Greg had killed her. But to say so would only damage the kids. Addison rooted through the bag. He needed something to do. Andrea was asleep. Delilah and Phoebe were cloistered away in a lair of female bonding. The chief had the twins, and Jeffrey was consumed with his own boys. From the bag, Addison removed pieces of Tupperware, some still containing food. He inspected the contents of one. A half-eaten lobster sandwich,
Had this been Tess's sandwich? Had her lips touched the bread? Addison lifted out the picnic basket. The fibers were waterlogged and disintegrating. He pulled out Tess's flip-flops. Size 5.5 J. Crew flip-flops in red and navy grosgrain ribbon. He turned them. Her tiny, doll-like feet had been in these shoes this morning. Her feet were so small she had a hard time finding shoes that fit. He would keep these flip-flops. But no, he couldn't. Where would he put them? What would he do with them? He yanked out Greg's deck shoe, which most closely resembled an overcooked steak, two striped beach towels, a small suitcase. Did Addison dare open it? He did not. Then he came across Tess's iPhone wrapped in its sunny yellow prophylactic. Addison didn't think. This was her cell phone. It was important. It was evidence. There was the text, "I'm afraid." And who knew what else she'd kept or erased? Addison crammed the phone into his pants pocket. He pitched the Ziploc bag into the trash. Would the chief notice that the phone was missing? He might. If he'd had the chance to study the contents of the bag of personal effects, he would notice. Would he have had that chance? The chief's afternoon had been frantic. He had gotten the whole story from the Coast Guard. More of the story than he was telling, certainly. Knowing Ed as Addison did, Addison realized that, yes, Ed would have found time to go through this bag. He may even have documented the contents. He would notice that the phone was missing. Well, that was too bad. If he wanted it, he could fight Addison for it. Addison needed air. The house was too warm. The wind had died down and the heat of the day was sticky and uncomfortable. Addison was going to vomit or faint. Tess was dead. She had been trapped under the boat, unable to swim out from under it. She had been afraid. God, just the thought of her fear and her panic, her struggle against the water, her need for air, her lungs about to explode, her cries for her kids, Chloe, Finn. She would have been thinking only of them in the end. Addison wanted to take the pilfered phone and get in his car and drive. Drive away, heedless and fast. He erupted with a broken shout, and tears blurred his vision. He stepped out onto the deck. All their cars were there in the driveway, except for the one that mattered. Never have to leave. Never have to say goodbye. He pulled the felt heart out of his pocket, and sure enough, it ripped. No, his heart. He held the two pieces together. Could it be glued? It looked like an apple with a bite missing. He put the two pieces of the torn heart in his pocket. It was the only thing Tess had ever given him. "This," she'd said, "is my heart." Phoebe. Phoebe envied Delilah for many reasons, and today another reason was added to that list. Delilah was able to express her grief fully and plainly, like a child. She was in her bed, curled in the fetal position, crying like a baby, sobbing, hiccuping, catching her breath, wiping her nose and face, and then collapsing all over again. She was hysterical. Nothing would stop her. And that had to feel good. Phoebe lay on the other side of Delilah's bed. She stretched out and covered Delilah's body with her own. She made a shushing sound as she might for a baby. These gestures didn't seem to be making any difference to Delilah, but Phoebe stayed there. She felt, as ever, that she was watching the rest of the world from behind frosted glass. There was a barrier between her and everyone else. That barrier had come down for the first time in 8 years today, when she had gone to find Addison. She had lost it. The news of Greg and Tess dead, delivered by Sophie from her Pilates class, whose husband served in the Coast Guard, had shattered the frosted window, and Phoebe had found herself face to face with horror. Phoebe had been through it all before. Reed. Her twin brother had been, how to explain, the dearest person in her life. He had always been there. Since Phoebe was conceived, since the womb, since her first day on Earth, the two of them had been a pair, pink and blue, a matched set, meant to be together. The twin relationship sometimes backfired. Phoebe had heard all kinds of weird, twisted stories. When Phoebe was in her 20s, she finally heard her parents speak of the concerns they had had when Phoebe and Reed were young. "You were too close. You spoke only to each other. We wanted to take you to see a therapist." Phoebe and Reed had developed their own language, which their mother feared was meant to keep the rest of the world at a distance. But when Phoebe thought back to her childhood, there was only peace, comfort, and constant safe companionship. She and Reed liked each other. They were considerate of each other, even as teenagers. They realized that hurting each other would be akin to hurting themselves. Reed was handsome and popular and smart. He played soccer, basketball, lacrosse. Phoebe was beautiful and popular and smart. She was editor of the yearbook, and she was a cheerleader. Reed helped Phoebe with her trig. She helped him with his paper for American Lit. He was math and science. She was English and history. Reed could draw. Phoebe could sing. They both sucked at French. Phoebe called him Reedy, Reader, Free Bird, Sweet Reedy Bird. He in turn called her Twist, short for Twister, short for Twin Sister. Did people tease them? It was possible, behind their backs. They were too good, too cute and perfect, too close. One night after basketball practice, Reed came home with a swollen eye. Something had happened, a fight with Todd Carroll, a boy Phoebe had broken up with before Christmas. In the locker room, Todd had said something crass about Reed and Phoebe, and Reed had gone wild. Todd Carroll had been sent to the hospital with a broken arm. Rather than being upset, Phoebe was dismissive. "The rest of the world doesn't understand," she said. Later that year, Phoebe and Reed were in danger of being voted homecoming king and queen. They both won, but after the Todd Carroll incident, Phoebe understood that the student body wouldn't be able to handle it. Since Phoebe was on the homecoming committee, she fixed the vote so that Shelby Duncan, who was Reed's girlfriend and had come in second place, was named the winner. Phoebe and Reed went to college at the University of Wisconsin. They led separate lives in a natural way. Reed played varsity soccer, majored in business admin, and pledged TKE. Phoebe majored in communications and pledged Alpha Kappa Delta. They spoke on the phone daily and met for lunch at the dairy every Wednesday, just the two of them. After college, they both moved to New York City. Phoebe lived in Chelsea and slugged it out as a catalog model for nearly a year before she got a job with Elder Hostel. Reed lived on the Upper East Side. He worked for Goldman Sachs first, then went to Columbia Business School, then got a job with Cantor Fitzgerald. They still talked on the phone every day. And with the convenience of cell phones, it was usually 2 and 3 times a day, and they had lunch every Wednesday at Pastis. Their grandfather died. They drove back to Wisconsin for the funeral together. Reed went through a bad breakup with a woman 10 years older than he who happened to be number 3 on the masthead at Vogue. Phoebe met him at McSorley's, and they got wickedly drunk and hung out on the swings at the Bleecker Street playground until 4 in the morning. Phoebe could go on and on explaining and still not quite capture what she was trying to get across. She did not fight with Reed. When they disagreed, they did so nicely. They knew each other too well to fight. They understood each other completely. The bottom line was, Phoebe had never in her life felt lonely, because she always had Reed, her best friend, her double. He was she was he. They were pink and blue, 2 halves of a whole. Reed met a girl and got married, moved to Connecticut. Phoebe loved her sister-in-law, Ellen Page, and helped her organize junior league luncheons in New Canaan. Phoebe then met Addison and moved to Nantucket. The Wednesday lunches became a thing of the past, but Phoebe and Reed still talked on the phone 2 or 3 times a day. They spent a week together in Wisconsin at Christmas. Reed and Ellen Page came to Nantucket for a week in June. Phoebe and Addison went to Connecticut for a week in October. Ellen Page got pregnant and had a baby boy. His name was Domino, but Phoebe called him Sweet Reedy Jr. She spoiled him rotten, sending him a monogrammed bathrobe, a full Brio train set, a 4-foot stuffed giraffe from FAO Schwartz. "I'm an auntie, the auntie." Reed's baby was her baby. In my will, Phoebe said. Everything goes to him. What could Phoebe say about September 11th that hadn't already been said in 60 languages? It was a beautiful day. Addison got up early to go shark fishing with Bobby D. Phoebe was headed to the gym, but she gagged and spit in the kitchen sink over the smell of her usual espresso. She was grossed out, but she was happy too. She was pregnant. She, Phoebe Wheeler, was going to have a baby. Phoebe hadn't even realized she wanted a baby. In fact, when asked, she was adamant that she didn't want a baby. She didn't want to ruin her body. She didn't want to cramp the lifestyle that she and Addison had cultivated. She didn't want to deal with poop or vomit or her own filled-to-bursting milkmaid breasts, which would undoubtedly leak all over her Ely Tahari camisole tops. But since Domino had come into the world, Phoebe had softened toward the idea. She would have a baby girl, and her daughter and Domino would be Reed and Phoebe, the next generation. On September 11th, she was 11 weeks and 4 days along. She and Addison had gone for an amniocentesis and found out that the baby was perfectly healthy, and yes, it was a girl. There was no reason Phoebe couldn't exercise, the doctor said. In fact, she should exercise. Just don't overdo it and be sure to eat. Phoebe blanched. She was not a big eater. She feared calories as if they were poisonous spiders, and now, with the nausea, even her usual diet of espresso, celery sticks, and fat-free yogurt dip wouldn't stay down. At the gym, Phoebe got on the treadmill. Only 3 days until her first trimester was over, and she could tell people she was pregnant. She had told her parents, of course, and Reed and Ellen Page, and Delilah and Jeffrey and Tess and Greg and Andrea and the chief. But, for example, Jeremy, the adorable boy who checked IDs at the front desk of the gym, didn't know. He must have looked at the slight swell of Phoebe's belly and thought she was eating too much banana pudding, complete with Nilla wafers and whipped cream. This was Phoebe's favorite dessert, but she didn't let herself get within 100 yards of it. Phoebe wanted to stick by the first trimester rule because she felt that the only thing worse than miscarrying would be people pitying her for miscarrying. Phoebe had always been lucky and blessed. Her life had been happy. Pity was foreign and horrible to her. She feared it more than calories or poisonous spiders. As Phoebe ran, she watched the Today Show. It was 8:30. There was a half-hour limit on the machines at the gym, but if there wasn't a line, which there wouldn't be now that all of the summer people had gone home, she could push it to 60 minutes. At 9:05, Phoebe was hitting a wall. She was feeling worn down, shaky, short of breath. The doctor had told her not to overdo it. She should stop. She had a Pilates class at 4 anyway. But she put on her headphones and kept going. She was listening to Taylor Dane sing Tell It to My Heart, and her feet were moving now. She had her second wind. She was feeling better than she had all summer. And this was what all the pregnancy books said. The day will come when the nausea and fatigue will end, and the pregnant woman will feel good. Phoebe was thinking about this, wondering if it was okay to believe that her turning point had arrived today, Tuesday, September something, when she noticed something happening on TV. The Today Show was cut short. They had Tom Brokaw on, looking very serious. Then there was footage, a plane flying into the side of a tall building. People crowded in among the treadmills, trying to see the TV. Jeremy from the desk was among them. Phoebe was hesitant to slow down or stop. Her pace was perfect. She was having that experience when her body and the machine were working optimally together. She kept going. Again, they showed the plane flying into the building. More people crowded in. They didn't want to use the treadmill. They just wanted to watch the news. Phoebe removed her right earbud and said to Jeremy, "What's going on?" "A plane hit the World Trade Center," he said. Phoebe gagged. "Okay, wait. She punched the correct sequence of buttons on the treadmill to make it slow down, then stop. Her insides were a brewing storm. She was going to lose her bowels right there on the treadmill in front of everyone. Another indignity of the pregnant body. She could not get her breath. She had that shaky, hot diarrhea feeling. She was afraid to move for fear of erupting. There was a word on her tongue, one word, but she had to deal with her personal emergency first. Get out of the gym. She had to get her bag, her phone. She had to get to her car. Before leaving the gym, she checked the TV screen again. The World Trade Center? In New York City? Of course, that's what the building was. She had been watching the screen just like everybody else. She had seen the plane fly into the building, through the building, just like everybody else. But she had been so inward-looking, so consumed with the cardiovascular and reproductive systems of her own body, that she had not thought to wonder where the building was. If pressed, she would have said Jerusalem or Lebanon or some other part of the world where planes flew into buildings, either because political strife was a part of the everyday or because they just weren't as careful as Americans. But New York City? The World Trade Center? She was holding the word in her mouth like a piece of hard candy. She spit it out. Read. She ran down the stairs to her car, dialing. Number one on her speed dial, before Addison even, was Reed at work. Cantor Fitzgerald, 101st floor, the World Trade Center, Tower 1. She got his voicemail.
Jesus, Reed, call me,
she screamed. Two women Phoebe knew vaguely were getting out of their cars in the parking lot. One of them, Jamie, said,
Hey, Phoebe, are you okay?
Phoebe waved, got into her car.
Call Addison.
The receptionist at Addison's office, Florabelle, answered the phone. Phoebe detested Florabelle and suspected the feeling was mutual. Phoebe said,
Addison, please.
Florabelle didn't recognize Phoebe's voice because Phoebe's voice was held hostage by panic. Florabelle said,
Mr. Wheeler is out of the office today. Would you like his voicemail?
Shit, Addison was fishing. Phoebe hung up. She tried Addison's cell phone and got his voicemail. He was so far offshore he would never have reception. She called Reed back. It was 9:05.
Hey, Twist, he said.
His voice was calm, but in the background Phoebe could hear shouting, which seemed more frenzied than the usual Cantor shouting.
You would not believe what is happening here. Have you seen the news?
Sort of, she said.
Are you okay?
Well, I just threw up in my trash can, he said. Because I tell you what, people are dead over in that other building. You should see the smoke. It stinks, even in here.
What are they? Are they saying anything?
We're supposed to sit tight. Some of the guys, Ernie, Jake, you know, they want to go to the ground to watch, but there's debris falling. It's safer, I think, to stay put.
You think?
That's what...
What?
Phoebe said. She couldn't hear.
I'll call you back when the dust settles, okay? I love you. I'm going to be fine, I promise.
Okay,
Phoebe said.
I have to call Ellen Page. She's at playgroup with Domino, but when she hears about this, she's going to freak.
Okay, I love you, Phoebe said.
Hey, he said. How are you feeling?
Me?
Phoebe said. I feel fine.
There was a noise. Honestly, it sounded like a lion roaring or a wave crashing over her head. The line went dead. Phoebe nearly sideswiped the mailman who was filling boxes on Old South Road. She watched footage of the plane hitting the second tower on Addison's 60-inch plasma TV in the closed-up, air-conditioned, professionally decorated comfort of her own home. Outside, the day shimmered. Nantucket was as tranquil and lovely as it had ever been. Phoebe turned her stare outside, in a daze. According to Tom Brokaw, America was under attack. Phoebe waited for the planes to come screaming over the ocean. Nothing. A monarch butterfly settled momentarily on the picnic table, then flew away. On the TV, a plane hit the second tower, which was Tower 1, again and again. Phoebe was riveted. Show it again. She was counting floors and dialing Reed from her landline.
Pick up!
She screamed into the phone. No one was around. No one could hear her. Their neighbors on both sides had left after Labor Day. Her call went to Reed's voicemail.
Call me!
She screamed. It looked like the plane had hit the second tower, Tower 1, about two-thirds of the way up. Definitely lower than the 101st floor. Were there 105 floors or 110? She couldn't remember. Her phone rang. Delilah. Phoebe let it go. She could not talk to Delilah. She counted floors down from the top. They flashed back to Tom Brokaw.
Show the building!
She screamed. No one on TV could hear her. Another channel, CNN, showed the towers smoking, blazing. This channel showed people hanging out their windows. Hanging out their windows so far up? What if they fell? They were waiting for the helicopters to come. Where were the helicopters? Was the National Guard going to send in helicopters for the people who were trapped above the flames? Phoebe had seen it countless times in the movies. This was the United States. The government, the military, the people in fucking charge would use their expensive, cutting-edge technology to rescue the people hanging from their windows.
Send the helicopters!
She screamed. Where were the fucking helicopters? At some point it hit her. This was real. Reed was in that building. He was clinging to that office window. The very same window that for years had afforded him what he called the billion-dollar view. Because the temperature inside, they said, was 3,000 degrees. Was that correct? Was there even such a thing as 3,000 degrees? Phoebe was on her knees. She was freezing, shivering, convulsing. The TV showed people jumping. Jumping from the 101st floor? Was there a team of firemen on the ground holding one of those inflatable parachutes that would catch these people, that would make their landing marshmallow soft? No. The TV said the jumpers most likely would suffer a heart attack on the way down. They were dead on arrival. They splattered like a watermelon falling off the back of the farm truck. The jumpers had so much velocity, the TV said, that they were killing bystanders at the bottom. At that moment, or a moment later, Reed jumped. Phoebe felt it. She too was falling. In high school, in the French class that Phoebe and Reed detested, both of them barely hanging on to a B-, their teacher showed a film called The Corsican Brothers, about twins who felt each other's pain. One breaks his arm, the other screams. Reed and Phoebe developed a Corsican Brothers shtick for a while. Reed would bump his shin, Phoebe would howl. You're a regular vaudeville act, their father said. Was there a spiritual connection between them? Did they feel each other's pain? Sometimes people ask this, just as people always asked if they were fraternal or identical. Hello, world's dumbest question. No, they said. And yet there was something. A few years earlier, Reed had gone skiing in Telluride with Cantor clients, and something went wrong on one of the runs. There was an avalanche of sorts, leaving Reed buried to his waist, unable to move or even reach his cell phone for 90 minutes. Phoebe, who was on Paradise Island in the Bahamas with Addison, felt her feet go numb. She could not feel her feet, not even when she grabbed her toes or walked over the scorching tiles around the swimming pool. Something's wrong with Reed, she said. She called him, and his cell phone rang and rang. She made Addison go to the concierge desk to track down the number of the mountain in Telluride. Later, when Reed was nursing his frostbite, wrapped in blankets in front of the lodge fire with a hot toddy, they laughed over the phone and said, Corsican Brothers. So, yes, there was something. But never anything as powerful as the feeling that overcame Phoebe at that moment on September 11th. She had leaped out into the billion-dollar view. She was floating. And then there was a rush, friction like she was being sucked through a tunnel. The air was devouring her. She tried to fight back but couldn't move her arms. Her arms were pinned to her side. And then suddenly, her arms were over her head. She was upside down,
She was going off the high dive at the Whitefish Bay Pool Club. She was going to hit any second, break the surface with a resounding splash, and have a strawberry back from the impact. But there was no impact. She was still falling, keening. The air ripped her hair out, her teeth out. She was blind. She was deaf. There was so much air she couldn't breathe. The wind ripped her up. It rubbed against her like flint, and she ignited. She burst into flame like a star. Reed was gone, and so was she. She did not cry. She curled up on the sofa and shivered. The phone rang. At first, she checked the display in case it was Reed, in case he had decided in a rush of fraternity brother camaraderie to go downstairs with Ernie and Jake to watch from the ground. But it was everyone else calling. Delilah again. Ellen Page, the chief, Andrea, Tess, Phoebe's mother, Ellen Page. And finally, Addison. She did not answer. These people left messages on her machine. She sensed concern, the chief. She sensed hysteria, Ellen Page, her mother. But she could not hear anything clearly. She was deaf from the wind in her ears. She couldn't watch the TV anymore, but she couldn't stop watching. The plane hit the building. It pushed right through it like a poison dart through the wall of a straw hut. She thought of people jumping. It was jump or melt. And Reed, whose life had been just as blessed as Phoebe's until this very morning, would have weighed two impossible options and decided to jump. Would his red cape work? He chose to believe it would. For Domino's sake, Ellen Page's sake, their mother's sake, Phoebe's sake. Free bird. Sweet, reedy bird. I'll call you back when the dust settles here. When the dust settles. On TV, the buildings collapsed like a house of cards. By the time Addison got home, sunburned and smelling strongly of fish, Phoebe had vomited all over their $17,000 silk oriental rug, hand-knotted in Tehran, and she had wet herself. Her gym shorts were soaked. She didn't care. Nothing mattered anymore. Not even when Addison gasped and said, "Jesus, Phoebe!" And she realized that she had not wet herself. She was sitting in a pool of her own blood. It was now